Now, we're holding on page 42 in Bava Metzia, Ois Ches. One of the Mishnayos, and the topic of the Perek is Shomrim and their responsibilities and so forth. So you have the Mishnah describes a case where a person is mafkid, deposits for safekeeping, some produce by somebody else. That produce is starting to rot away or otherwise to be lost. The Mishnah says, so what should you do with it? So the Tanakhama of the Mishnah says, leave it alone. Lo yugabahem. The Gemara explains because the Tanakhama holds that a person wrote so to Makab Shaloi, Mekisha Kaban Shachaber, a person would rather have even a smaller amount of his own produce than a larger amount from somebody else. So as long as there's something left of his, then he'd rather have that rather than having it be sold and eventually have to buy other produce. On the other hand, Rav Shimon Gamliel says in the Mishnah that no, the guy, the Shomer, should go and have based and evaluate the current value of it and sell it so that it doesn't cause the owner of the produce further loss. And the Gemara discusses ins and outs of it. Does it make a difference how much of it is rotting away, et cetera, et cetera? Obviously, also, we have to assume we're talking about a case where the Shomer doesn't have the ability or at least not easily, to prevent it from rotting. Otherwise, that's his responsibility. But we're talking about where he doesn't, let's say. In any case, where he doesn't have that ability to prevent it from spoiling. In any case, so the Gemara goes into various ins and outs of these dinim, and then the Gemara says as follows. Here's another example where a person has property which is where he's not available to take care of it, and it's in danger of losing its value, and it's in danger of losing its value, or at least not getting the value that it should have. Namely, imagine you have a case where a person is taken prisoner or captured by an army. So now, what happens, let's say, for example, he had fields and things like that, should Beis Din appoint a relative or somebody like that to go and manage the field and take care of it in the guy's absence? And eventually, if he makes it back, then he'll be able to take it back over, and this way he won't have lost out. Or should we not? So the Gemara at first tries to relate it to this machlokas of the Chachamim and, of the Chachamim and Reb Shimon Gamliel.
Took him away.
It was captured by Goyim. Let's say Goyim, a Goyish army invaded a place and took Jews captive. Mm-hmm. And among them is a person who owns a local field or what have you. So the question is, should Beis Din make arrangements for somebody to go and take over and plow and plant and whatever that field in the guy's absence or not? So at first the Gemara tries to relate it to this Machalokas or Shimon Gamliel and the Chachamim. The Gemara ends up saying it's not really exactly the same, because in the case of the Mishnah, if the produce itself is getting damaged or lost, then there won't be anything left. Whereas in the case of the field, worst that happens is the field will just stay fallow, but the value of it is not going anywhere. It just won't produce the crops that it should have in the next year or two, or how long it's going to be until we find out. In any case, this brings the Gemara into...
In this case, it's the field that's being dead.
So that's the thing. The Gemara at first thought that it was the same thing, but the Gemara points out there's a difference. In the case of the Mishnah, you have he deposited wheat or wine or whatever with somebody else. If that's rotting or spoiling or whatever, the whole thing is going to be gone, as opposed to the field. If it's left empty, okay, it's left empty. It's not producing crops, but it's still the value of it is not going anywhere.
The case of the guy that was kept by Goy is the case of the field.
Or? That's the case of the field. Yeah. Okay, so now in this connection, the Gemara brings up the point. So now the Gemara brings the following piece. So you're saying there is a possibility that if a Yid was captured by Goyim, there's a possibility that we should have somebody take over, that we should have his children or other relatives take over the field and manage it and then plow and plant and do whatever of it in his absence until the Ezer Sashemi gets out of captivity. The Gemara asks, though, from the following braisa. The Braisa quotes a pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim, but Hashem says that if you mistreat a yosim or an almana, call a kalamon of yosim leisanun, and if a person does, then they're going to cry out. And Hashem says, v'chora api, my anger will flare, v'haragti eschem v'chorev, and I will kill you with the sword, v'horyun sheichem almanus uvnechem yisoimim, and your wives will be widows and your children will be orphans. So the Braisa says, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Mimash Meshenema V'chora Api V'horag Di'eschem. If the Pasuk is saying, Hashem is saying that the people who do this are going to be killed, Yedei Ani Shene Shesem Amonis of Neim Yisoyim. Well, automatically, if the person's dead, then his wife's an Amona and his children are Yisoyim. So El Ma Tamar Lema V'horim Yisheichem. What is the Pasuk adding by mentioning that point? So Malamed, it teaches us that they're going to be a different kind of Amona and Yosem as usual. Malamed, the situation is going to be, we're not talking about that necessarily the person is actually going to be killed. He's going to be taken captive by Goyim, and they won't know what happened to him. So therefore, so Malamed Shanishisem of Akrish Vinyase, so the wife will want to get remarried, the Ein Manichanos, and then Beis Din won't allow her to because we don't have solid evidence that her husband is dead. Uvneim Roitz and Laird Lemichsabim, and the sons are going to want to go and take over their father's property, the Ein Manichanos, and then again, Beis Din won't allow it because what if the father is still alive? So the point is, in other words, Rashi says, so we have two things over here. The person, So the person may actually be there's actually two klolos involved over here. The person is taken captive and then he's killed, but they don't know what happened to him. So therefore the point is the Gemara brings this in on the face of it based on that brisa, then that means that you're not allowed to, when a person was taken captive and we don't know what happened to him, that you're not allowed to go and take over his property and start managing it. So the Gemara had brought it again in connection with this whole situation. When you have that, what would be the deen? The Gemara goes on with the rest of the discussion, and the next couple of pieces that we're going to have over here in Ein Yaakov also relate to that point. Maharsha explained a couple of other things about this. First of all, Maharsha says it can be talking about that the person was actually killed, but there's not, but even if there were Edim, the Gemara tells us in Yevamah, the Gemara has the last two prokim of Yevamah deal in detail with these dinim under what kind of evidence is acceptable that a person has died or not. Sometimes you have what the Gemara calls the didomi. You have where they think the person was killed, but he actually wasn't. He actually made it out alive. So then that's even more so. So not only here, Rashi is saying the person is taken captive and we don't know what happened to him, but now Maharsha is saying there could even be Edom actually come to Beis Din and said that we saw him being killed. However, because it was a wartime and because the situation is that they may have misunderstood what happened, then therefore, for that reason alone, Beis Din is not going to allow the wife to remarry or the children to take over the property. The Al-Shach HaKadosh mentions in his Pidush on the Pasuk that the Midah Keneged Midah over here is that when a person mistreats a Yosem or an Amana, every time such a thing happens to them, they feel bad. You know, if our husband or our father were still alive, then he would be standing up for us. Well, therefore the person himself, his family, ends up in that situation as well. So a couple of Mephoshim deal with various detailed angles in this. Ion Yaakov points out that, okay, so if his wife can't be married, why is that so bad for the mess? Adarabe, isn't it more of a covered for him that his wife is still attached to him and doesn't remarry? But no, the point is that Mevakshin Linase says they want to get married, meaning they go to Beis Din. And we have an expression, the Gemara has an expression, in some places, Eindonim Rochech is Baze Ishtab Beis Din. A person doesn't want his wife to be degraded and humiliated by having to go in front of Beis Din. Well, here she's going, and then after all, they tell her, I'm sorry, we can't help you. So that's even worse. Beni Hoyada mentions also there can be a situation where, let's say, fine, they have possible evidence that he's dead, but they don't know for sure, and they wind up having to open up the kever, which you're allowed to in certain rare cases in halacha, to check whether it really is him. That's a tremendous bizarrion for the mess. In any case, again, the Gemara had brought this in to ask that on the face of it, based on that braisa, we see Ein Manichanoisen, that they don't allow them to go in, so what are you telling me that there's a possibility that they do? And the Gemara discusses it can mean they don't allow them to sell it, maybe it means they would be allowed to work the land, just not to sell it. The Gemara goes through a discussion about it. Okay. Further on in the Sugya, the Gemara discusses there are a number of cases where that are relevant to this as far as when a person is missing. So first it mentions a case of a shavui, where this is not an Ein Yaakov over here, but this is based on what we were just learning, that you can have a case where we know a person was captured by goyim, and therefore now we have to figure out what we do with what the local base then has to figure out what's to be done with his property. For the meanwhile, in many cases we do in fact allow a relative to go and take over the field and manage it on his behalf until he comes back. But now the braisa continues. On the other hand, if a person goes into property of nitushin, and the Gemara is going to explain in a few lines that nitushin means somebody who is missing, but we don't know where he is, but we don't know for sure that he was captured. He left the country or whatever, and he left the country voluntarily even, whatever, but we don't know whether he's still alive.
What's the meaning of
Netushin? That Netushin means abandoned. The Gemara is going to bring a pasuk soon. So Ayur and the Nichsin Netushin might see an Osin Miyodre. We take them away from him, namely, you have no business unilaterally going over and starting to manage the guy's property. Mela Shavui, he was taken captive unexpectedly. He wouldn't have had the time before he was captured by the Goyim to give instructions what they should do with his property. So therefore, we can say that he might well prefer that the field should continue to remain productive, and therefore that somebody should be managing it for him. But if he's Netushin, if he left voluntarily, then if he wanted to give instructions, he should have given instructions. So therefore, with Sionos and Miyadeh, we take it away from him. The Elo and Nichsin Netushin, what is the definition of Netushin? Suppose a person's father or brother or one of the other people that he's in line to inherit from went off to overseas, and they haven't heard that he died. So therefore, we can't just decide on our own that his son or whatever should be taking it over and managing it. However, Reb Shimon Gamliel says, "Shamaitish on Netushin kishvuyin." I have heard that Netushin is the same as shvuyin as far as this halacha, and the same way as by a shavuy, you can have a son or whatever start managing the property the same way by Netushin as well. Well, then the Braisa continues, "Hayur lemifse ritushin." On the other hand, if a person goes to and wants to start managing the property of ritushin, the Gemara is going to explain soon, is a lashon of even more voluntarily. Like netushin, there's a certain compulsion. Like for example, so shvuyin would be he was actually captured by goyim. Netushin, for example, would be where he had to leave the country because of an emergency or something. Let's say, for example, we had a week or two back, we had at the end of Bava Kamma, the story was Kahana killing a would-be Moiser and Rav telling him you have to get out of town, you have to move to Eretz Yisrael. So that would be a case of Netushin. Ritushin is where he left completely voluntarily. So then for sure, so by Netushin, on the one hand, you can say he's leaving, he wasn't actually captured by Goyim, therefore maybe you shouldn't be taking over his property. On the other hand, Reb Shimon Gamliel can say, listen, you know, it was by force, he was forced to leave because otherwise he's going to get arrested or whatever. So fine, he didn't have the chance to give instructions beforehand. But Ritushin, where he's leaving completely voluntarily, if he wanted something to be done, he should have given instructions about it. We do in fact take it away from him, and we tell him you have no right to do that unless you have explicit instructions for him to that effect. What's the definition of retushin? They're here. They didn't leave the country. They just don't know right now where they are. So they didn't even have to leave the country. So we're not talking about there was nothing forcing them to leave. They just decided, whatever it is, they decided to go on a cruise or something. Well, then in that case, you need to wait for instructions from them before you do anything. Well, the Gemara says, Maishna hanach tekorilu netushim, umaishna hani tekorilu ritushim. Well, what is the actual difference? Why in one case are we calling it netushim and in the other case ritushim? What do those respective words really mean? And the answer is netushim deval kochay. Netushim with a nun suggests that it's against his will. So maybe not completely against his will. Maybe he wasn't actually taken captive by Goyim, but nevertheless, it's still there's a certain element of compulsion over there.
A certain element of
compulsion of having been forced to of having been forced to leave. Rashi actually says that netushim would be to go into nishbu. So it's not exactly nishbu because nishbu would be shvuyin, but in other words, it's similar enough. And we can see that, because the pasuk says, when it comes to shmita, you have to stop working your field, and you have to netashta. And what does netashta mean? Afkaita demalka, there's a commandment of the king that takes it away from you and says it's not yours for the duration of shmita. So therefore, the netushim suggests that you're being forced by a higher power. In this case, Hashem is requiring you, farmer, think you own this land, but now in Shemitah, you realize that you don't actually own it. Afkaita actually means like expropriation, like sometimes you would have in some, even nowadays, sometimes, you know, you have, let's say, the concept of eminent domain, right? You know, a person owns a house or a property or whatever, and the government wants to build a road over there, then they have a certain legal right to take it away from you and tell you, we'll pay you for it, but you need to give it up because we need to build this road or we need to do whatever. So here, afkaita de malka means basically the same kind of thing. Hashem is saying, for the next year, this field doesn't actually belong to you. And it's called unatashta, so therefore that's netushin is the same shodesh. It's, by the way, machloikas, an interesting machloikas. between the Beis Yosef and then the Mabit, they were Bali Plugta in many areas of Halacha, including in several issues of Shemitah, and one of them is on this question of is there a specific mitzvah for the farmer at the beginning of Shemitah to say, I am mafkir my land, or is it doesn't matter, Hashem is automatically mafkir it for him, basically. In that case, that's Natushim. Ritushim, on the other hand, the word Ritushim with a resh means the midaita, means completely voluntarily. Dichtiv, as we find a pasuk in Hosea, Eim al bonim rutosha. The mother, and together with the children, have been abandoned. So what is that pasuk talking about? So Rashi brings, you have to read the whole pasuk, Rashi says, in order to understand what the Gemara is saying over here. The Navi Hosea, he's speaking, he was one of the Nevi'im in the times of the first Beis HaMikdash. He was mainly speaking to the kingdom of the Aseret HaShevatim and warning them of the consequences of their Averis, and there's going to be a Golos as there in the end was, the Golos of the Aseret HaShevatim. So he tells them like this, the Kom Sha'in Va'amecha, there will arise a tumult, a noise, a nervousness among your people. Namely, Rashi says, so here, the whole passage goes like this. V'kom shoyin v'amecha, there will arise a tumult among your people. V'chom v'sarecha yushad, and all of your fortresses will be emptied. T'shoyd shalman beis arvel, v'yom milchama, like the emptiness of Shalman, Meloshin Shalom, on a day of Arvel, on a sudden ambush attack, the Yom Mocham, on a day of war, Eim Abonim Ritosha, the mother and the children are abandoned. So Rashi goes into a little explanation over here. What does the pasuk mean? Rashi says fairly similarly on the actual pasuk in Hosea. We go like this. One second. Abandoned. Left, abandoned. Okay. So, like this, Rashi explains. Become shoin b'amecha. They're going to be afraid. They're going to be nervous in advance that they're going to be attacked by enemies. So we're not even talking about that there's an actual enemy attacked right now. They're going to be so paranoid that there's going to be one. This is the Navi is warning them. If you don't do tshuva, then this is the kind of mentality that you're going to end up having. So what's going to happen? V'chomer sarecha yushad. So all of your fortresses are going to be emptied out. Like people are going to voluntarily go into Golos, and their cities and fortresses will remain empty. Keshod shalman beis arvel b'yom mochama. Like when you have that, when you have like the kind of thing. Like normally, when would you run away in large groups like that, and everybody run for their lives? Would be when you have actual attackers coming and ambushing them and. And then people are living there peacefully, and all of a sudden you have like the Simchas Torah attack, you know, you're peacefully there in your kibbutzim, and all of a sudden you have terrorists parachuting in over there. So now the Navi is warning, it's not even going to be that there's an actual attack. You're going to be so paranoid that you're going to be running away thinking that there's going to be an attack. And then he finishes off, Eim Abonim Rutosha, so the mothers and the children are going to be abandoned, like the men, in other words, are going to be so afraid and so paranoid that they're just going to go and run for their lives as though there's already an attack, and not caring about the fact that they're leaving their women and their wives and children behind. So we see that the pasuk Rutosha over there refers to that they're leaving fairly voluntarily. It's only because they have this sudden fear that there's going to be an attack, and therefore they leave. But therefore, the word retushin can refer more to people who leave more voluntarily rather than that they're forced to, as netushin means. Rashi on the pasuk, by the way, gives a different explanation of rutosha that doesn't really have to do with our Gemara. He says that another meaning of rutosha, the aim of bonim rutosha, he says means the enemies are going to break open and split open the mothers with the children, like we have in Al-Maris Bavel, Asher Shirich is Benifetis Alayich Al-Asala. So Rashi explains that it can also mean the same kind of thing over here. It's talking about the cruelty of the goyim when they do attack. But Rashi gives another explanation, and then over there on the pasuk, and over here in the Gemara, that we're not even talking about the goyim are actually attacking yet. We're talking about the people are running away out of fear of an attack, even though there's nothing, even though right now you would expect them to be at peace and not to have to be worrying about anything. Okay. Further on in the sugya, again, still talking about this matter of taking over property that belongs to that belongs to somebody who's now missing. So now, a related point, the Gemara brings up, what if that property belongs to a child? Now, if it belongs to an adult, Mela, at least in a way, it's not so bad if a relative or somebody else comes and takes it over temporarily, because even if the guy makes it back from captivity or whatever, fine, he'll take the person to Beis Din and get everything straightened out. But a child is not going to know what to do. What if a child owns property and then he's taken captive? He's not going to know if he ever makes it back. He's not going to have the ability to know what actually happened over here and take the person to Beis Din. So it's going to come out, basically, that the relative took over his property illegally. So the Gemara deals with rules as far as that, and eventually it gets to the following story, which is also related to that, in the sense that we're going to have an older brother and a younger brother and the disposition of property. So the Gemara tells the following story. Mori bar Isaac, and that was his name, he was a gvir in those days, he's mentioned in a number of places in Shas, also like Achami Bechoza, a brother came to him, or at least somebody who was saying that he was his brother, from Bechoza. Bechoza is an area nowadays, it's part of Iran, it's the area where Iran has most of its oil wells, it's quite a distance from Babel. The Gemara often mentions it as an example of a place, like the people in Babel tended to do a lot of business there, and people would travel back and forth, but it was quite a distance away. So Rashi explains that Mori bar Isaac's father, Isaac, had years earlier gone to Bechoza and married a woman over there, and they had this son. Meanwhile, he moved the whole family to Bechoza for his business. Now, eventually, when Mori got older, he returned to Bavel and took over his father's estate over there after his father passed away. Meanwhile, now, he didn't remember, or at least he didn't recognize this brother from years earlier. So now, all of a sudden, the guy shows up one day and says, "I'm your brother." So that's one way Tosfos understands a little bit different. It's also possible that he did know. So in the example we're saying over here, it comes out basically that Mori maybe didn't even know that he had a brother. Tosfos spells it out. He knew he had a brother, but not necessarily that this guy is him. Anyway, Amalei Ploigli. So this brother comes and says to Mori, "Divide the estate with me. I'm your brother. I'm entitled to a portion of the estate." Amalei. So Mori tells him, "Lo yadainalo. I don't know you. I don't know who you are." Also, Kamed Rav Chista. So the case was brought to Rav Chista. Amalei, Rav Chista tells this guy, the claimant, Shapir Kamalach. You know, Mori has a good point. He's saying something very true. Shenemar, just like we find by Yosef and his brothers. By Yakir Yosef as Echov, Yosef recognized his brothers. Vehem lo yikiruhu, but they didn't recognize him. Why? Melamed, because this teaches us, Sheyotzaboy Chasimas Zakan, or Baba Chasimas Zakan. When he left them, when they sold him, when he was 17, he didn't yet have a beard. Or if he had a beard, it was just not enough to be recognizable by yet. And now they're seeing him with a full beard, so they couldn't recognize him. As opposed to, So now Mephoshim point out that on the other hand, his brothers had beards, and there's some detail in that Mephoshim discussed. Maybe not every single one of them had beards. I mean, the Ramban on the Pasuk points out. So Rashi over here says all of them had chasimas zaken, all of them had beards. But on the other hand, the Ramban on the Pasuk points out. Wait a minute, Yisachar and Zvulun are not very much older than Yosef. So if he didn't have a beard at 17, who says that they did? So the Ramban says that fine. One answer that Mephoshim gives is, listen, he didn't have to recognize every single one of them, but once he recognizes Reuven and Shimon and Levi, because they're the older, and Yehuda, because they're the older ones, they're a few years older than him, and they had full beards when they sold him, so therefore once he recognizes them, then already he can recognize, well, the rest of that group must also be my brothers, even yet. In addition, I mean, there is also the point that Taras Chaim points out, Rashi mentions on the Pasuk, actually, I don't remember if Rashi mentions on the Pasuk, but in any case, the Medrash mentions that Yosef set up the system where everybody who comes to buy grain has to register at the gates, and they went to different gates, and each one signed their name. One gate he finds on the register, Reuven ben Yaakov, and another one, Shimon ben Yaakov, so by the time they come, he knows that they're coming anyhow. In any case, the point is, though, that so he didn't necessarily have a beard. H. Yosef points out, listen, Balabatish, you could say that not everybody grows a beard at the same time. Yosef may have been a little delayed in growing one. He's 17, he doesn't have one yet. Doesn't mean that Yisachar and Zvulun, they're 17 and a half, let's say, doesn't mean they didn't already have one. In any case, the point is, getting back to the Gemara, so Rav Chista says to this guy, you know, Mori is saying he doesn't recognize you. Well, yeah, because when was the last time he saw you? When you were a little kid. For that matter, Tosfos points out that not even necessarily if he did, what if they did last see each other when he had chasimas zaken? It's also a valid claim to say that I don't recognize you.
Did what?
If he had chasinas zaken, let's say this younger brother. Well, let's say when they last saw each other, this younger brother was 20 years old and he already had a beard. Tosfos points out it would still be valid for Mori Bar Yosef to say, "I don't know who you are." The difference is that over here, Mori is not actually saying, "I for sure don't know you." He's not saying, "I don't have a brother." He's not doing a tainus body. He's doing a tainus shema. He's doing, "I'm not sure. I know I have a brother, but I don't know if it's you because I don't recognize you." So if the guy had chasinas zaken, then that wouldn't be a valid counter argument. But if he says, because the guy didn't have chasinas zaken, then even a tainus shema, even a maybe claim is something important, and therefore, so listen, Rabbi, you need to bring proof. So Rav Chista tells the guy, "Zil Isi Sadi Dahuat." Well, go bring Adam that you're his brother. Amalei, but the guy says, "Isli Sadi, I do have Adim, Udvedachli Minei." However, those Adim are afraid of him, Degabra Almahu, because he's a powerful person. So they're afraid to go and testify him against him in Beis Din, because they're afraid of what the consequences might be. Amalei Vididei, sort of Chista turns to Mori and tells him, "Zil Ant, I see Sadi de Lava." In that case, bring Adim that he's not your brother. So it can mean actual Adim that he's not your brother. So Rashi says it would mean those same Adim. Now, how would those Adim know that this is Mori Bar Yosef's brother? Because they had been in Beit Chazor, they knew the family, and they could recognize him. So now, you bring them, and let's see if they testify that he's not in fact your father's son, or see if you can find other Adam. It doesn't matter. This points out it's not necessarily they have to say that he's not his brother, but it's enough if they say we don't know whether he's his brother.
Yes, he can bring a lot of people.
Okay, but he's saying these Adam. Amalei Dinah Hachi. So Mori asks, "Is that the din? Since when is that the din? Hamotzi Mechaber or Raya? This guy wants to be Motzi Mechaber. He wants to say that he's entitled to half the estate.
Proof.
So he's the one who has to bring the proof, as we learned in Baba Kama. Amalei. So Rav Chista answers him, "Hachi Daivinin Lacha or Lachal Almi Dechavrach." You know what? This is how we judge for you and other tough guys like you. When you have, you're such an intimidating guy that the Adim are, and apparently, in other words, Mori Bar Yosef, it wasn't just that he's a gvir. Apparently, he had a reputation that if you cross him, then you're not going to end up well for it. So when you throw around your weight like that, basically, and you're going to be this tough kind of guy, then this is how we have to judge for you. You're going to have to be the one who brings the Adis. So again, it doesn't, the Tosfos points out, I mean, listen, you know, the Shafkas Chaya L'chol Berio, what does that mean? A guy like that, anybody can start bringing Adim against him, but the point is, you know, in this particular case, it's not, if the guy said, "I don't have Adim because everybody that I talked to was afraid to come," then fine, Mela, but he was saying, "I have Adim, they're ready to come to Beis Din, but they're afraid of the consequences," then Rav Chista can tell Mori Bar Yosef, "You know what, then the responsibility really is on you." So the Gemara goes, the Ein Yaakov stops over here, but the Gemara goes on with the rest of the story. Eventually, Adim came that he was his brother, and they have to deal with the disposition of the estate, and it relates back to this whole point. In effect, what it means is that all this time, part of that estate belonged to this younger brother, including when he was a cotton, and that's how it relates to the previous piece of Gemara about a cotton who's not in town and somebody else. He was a cotton. He was a child. Now he's grown up, but back then he was a child. And it turns out that Mori Bar Yosef, his older brother, had been managing the property all those years on behalf of his, not knowing that his younger brother is still alive or whatever. But the point is, it relates to this whole sugya before that about a case where a child owns property and a relative is illegally managing it for him.
So the younger brother had been brought
proof. So in the end, he brought proof. Yeah. Further on in the parak, it talks about like this. So a shomer has a responsibility to guard, well, obviously as a shomer, he has to guard whatever it is that has been deposited with him. Now, different kinds of things are going to need different degrees of guarding different ways. But I'm summarizing it. For example, you know, you have, let's say you mafked heavy beams by somebody, so you can leave it in a chotzer. That's a reasonable place. You yourself, the basic idea being, in other words, wherever you yourself would tend to keep this kind of thing is where if somebody else was mafked it with you, then you have to do the same thing. So say, for example, somebody deposits with you beans for as a pikadon, then you can leave them in your chotzer. Suppose he deposits with you tools, you can leave them in your barn, and so on and so forth. So now the Mishnah describes that if he deposits money, then So the Mishnah gives examples. That the Mishnah gives examples where he didn't guard it properly, and then therefore he's chayev, and it's considered that pia, and therefore if the money gets stolen, then he's chayev. So the Gemara establishes that k'safim ein lahem shmira ela b'karka, the only safe way of keeping money is to bury it in the ground. So in this connection, the Gemara brings the following points. So the Mishnah also mentions like this, that you can have a case where the person tied up the money in a bundle and is carrying it with him, which fine, that's a good way of doing Shemira, but the Mishnah describes that he slung it behind his back. No good. If he's gonna be carrying it around with him in a bundle or a money belt or whatever, it has to be in front of him. And otherwise not considered a good Shemira. So it's really both. I mean, the Rambam explains, in other words, that it's both. If you're going to be staying at home, then you need to bury it in the ground. If you yourself, the Shomer, are going to be going on a trip, then you have to take the money along with you, or else find somebody, or else arrange for somebody else to take over the Shemira, if you can get permission from the original owner. Okay, so Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, lo olam yehekas b'shalot ha-motzi b'yadei. A person should always have his money ready to hand. As the pasuk says, you should tie up the money. This is talking about ma'aser sheni money in your hand. So we see the Torah is saying there's not just saying that tzarta kesef, tie it up, but biyodcha, it should be in your hand, ready at hand. Right before this, the Gemara had pointed out that that's also where we see that if you're going to be carrying money, you have to carry it in front of you rather than behind it. As we see that the Torah makes a point. of biyodcha. So then in this connection, we have this drasha as well, that it also means that you should make sure that your money is always ready at hand. Now, what's the point of it? Rashi says, don't be mafkid all of your money in somebody else's hands, because let's say, for example, a good business opportunity comes up. You want to have liquid cash to be able to take advantage of it. Iyun Yaakov points out another point as well. A poor person may come for tzedakah, and you want to be able to have cash right away on hand to give him. The Omer Rabbi Yitzchak, and Rabbi Yitzchak further says, he was another piece of advice as far as money. A person should always divide his money into thirds. Shlish b'karka, one third in karka. Now, one way of understanding shlish b'karka means, Marashah says, it can mean buried in the ground. As the Gemara goes on to say, about that money has to be buried in the ground, and that's the only way of keeping it safe, or at least that's how it was in those days. The other possibility, Marashah says, and a number of other Rishonim learn the same way, that it means that one third of your money should be used to buy land. Or shlish b'pakmatia, one third in merchandise that you're going to buy and sell. And one third ready to hand, again, like Rashi says, because that way you can take advantage of a good business opportunity, and like Iyun Yaakov says, rather, so this way also you have it ready made, you have it ready available to give tzedakah.
The
one third, not necessarily all of it is going to go for tzedakah, but this way, in case the tzedakah opportunity comes up, then, in other words, it comes out, basically, Rashi and Iyun Yaakov are both talking about respective business opportunities with money. One of them, a gashmiistic, a business opportunity, and the other one, a ruchniistic one. In any case, that's why you have to have one third of your cash should be liquid. Now, Marsha explains like this. Each one of these three things has an advantage over the other ones. Karka, if we take that, it means that shlish b'karka means one third you use to buy land. Well, land, the Gemara calls, throughout Shas, calls nechosim sheyesh lahem achrayus. And one meaning of that is other nechosim, other kinds of property, you could lose them in one moment. Thieves come, robbers come, whatever, a marauding army comes, and poof, the whole thing is gone. As opposed to karka is always going to be there. Or it's lower than my modest, as the pasuk says in Kehelis, the land's always going to be there. So there's an advantage, and it's always going to be there. It's always going to be there. It's not going anywhere. I mean, I guess if you have a piece of land, you know, like a piece of a cliff falls off into the ocean, okay, fine. But basically, the land is still always there, you know. So therefore,
it's called real estate.
Yeah, that's exactly why it's called real estate. Yeah. So there's an advantage in having money invested in real estate. There's an advantage, on the other hand, in he also refers to a Gemara in Yevamos that says that land has more of a bracha in it. Then you have one third in merchandise has an advantage because you can stand to earn more profits from merchandise. As in fact, that same Gemara in Yevamos points out, as much as there's an advantage to owning land and having a field or a farm of your own, in a way, there's a greater, in terms of making profits, in a way, you have much more profit-making opportunity when it comes to merchandise. So therefore, there's an advantage in that. And then the third that you have in your hand is a mila, again, that's available every moment for whatever kind of business opportunity, gashmiyistik or ruchniyistik, comes your way. So there's that. The Maharal points out another angle on it as well, that the land is considered in a way not yours, because it's always there. It was there before you came into the world. It's going to be there after you're gone, as opposed to prakmatia is more yours, but on the other hand, you're constantly buying and selling, so it doesn't remain with you for very long, whereas shlishtachas yada, a third of the money remains in your hand, so it's like more of a long-term possession of yours. So each one, again, has an advantage over the other ones. Continues the Gemara of Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Further, Rabbi Yitzchak says another piece of advice about money, well, not just about money, but about nechassim in general. Eina brocha mitzuya ela b'davar she'eina ayin sheletes bo. A brocha is found primarily only in things where the eye does not have domination over it. A couple of reasons why that can be. It can be because of an ayin hara, or it can be here we're talking about where the person himself doesn't see it, so obviously he's not going to give an ayin hara on himself, but it can be because, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, well, a brocha a lot of times involves Hashem is going to cause an increase in the thing. Many Mephoshim talk about the idea, the Torah Chaim on our Gemara, and others, is the idea that if Hashem is going to do a nes, generally speaking, Hashem does nisim in a way that's hidden within Teva. So if a person knows, for example, there's X amount over here, and later on he finds there's more, then that's a bracha. That's a nes, shaloi kederach hateva, and generally the Eibishter is not going to do that. As opposed to, you don't know exactly how much there is over here, and it's covered from the eye, then there's more likely to be a bracha in it, and then you won't know that a nes happened in the first place. As you have the expression, Chazal say, ein bala nes, makke benisa. Many times a person has a nes happen to him, and he doesn't even recognize that there was a nes, so then that's how the Eibishter prefers to work. Within Teva. So therefore, so a bracha is found only in something that's hidden from the eye. Shenema, as the passage says, Yitzav Hashem itcha, it's a bracha ba'asamecha. Hashem will command the bracha to come to you in asamecha. Now, the simple meaning of asamecha means your granary, the place where you store your grain or your other produce. But we're darshaning it, meloshin samui, meloshin hidden from the eye. Marshall mentions another point over here as well, besides for the matter of Ayin Hara and besides for the matter of different kinds of Nisim, there's also the Gemara in Chulin talks about that some things are exposed to attack by Shadim, but if they're tied up and then sealed up or whatever, then Shadim can't get to them. So that's another reason why it's better to keep them under wraps. In fact, Maharshal says that this goes also with the previous piece that we said that you should have the money tied up and bundled up in your hand. So it's both. You should have it tied up and bundled up so Shadim can't get to it, as well as it should be biyodcha so that you don't lose it or people don't steal it or whatever. So that's also, the bracha is found only in something that's hidden from the eye. Tonim ve'Rabbi Shmuel, in the yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel, they taught a braisa that learns it a little differently. Eina bracha mitzuya ela b'davar she'eina ayin she'letes bo'i. A bracha is found only in something where the eye does not have control over it. Shenema, the same pasuk, Yitzav Hashem itcha, it's a bracha ba'asamecha, the same thing with darshaning asamecha. So here, actually, Rashi explains, the difference is, Rabbi Yitzchok's drasha took the word asamecha as meloshin samui, meloshin hidden. Rabbi Shmuel is not doing that. He's saying the word asamecha itself means a storehouse, so it means something where it's stored away and out of sight. So different Mephoshim talk about a couple of nafkaminas between them. One of them is, for example, the Maharal talks about in his Chiddush HaGadol over here, there can be a difference whether you have something which is in front of your eyes, but you don't know the exact amount of it. The Gemara is going to now talk about, for example, a person goes to measure his heap of grain. He knows there's a heap of grain in front of him, he can see it, but he doesn't know exactly how much there is in it. So if we say it's a matter of eina ayin, of samui mina ayin, then there might not be such a bracha in it because he does see it in front of him. But if you say it's eina ayin sheletes boy, that means the eye doesn't dominate it, doesn't have control to know how much there is. Well, even with the heap of grain, you kaka don't know yet how much there is in there. So even Yaakov says something along the same, says something a little differently, that someone when Ayin would be, he never knew how much he was there, which is Rabbi Yitzchok's point. Tanad Rabbi Shmuel would be, let's say he knew how much there was, but now he doesn't remember how much there, and now he doesn't remember how much there is. So then there can still be a bracha in it, according to Tanad Rabbi Shmuel. So the Gemara continues that Tana Rabbanan haholach lomudas gonoi, when a person is going to measure the amount of grain in his granary, Omer, before he starts measuring, he should say Yehi Ratzon Melfanach Hashem Elokeinu Shetishlach Bracha B'Maasei Yadeinu. May it be your will, Hashem, that you should send a bracha in the work of our hands. So it's not, he's not saying a bracha yet, but he's asking a tefillah to Hashem that his work of everything that he put into to make it to producing this grain should be successful. Hiskalamud, when he starts measuring, when he starts measuring before he's gotten really into the measuring, Oimer, he used to say, when he's right up, he's about to measure right now, Oimer, he says, Baruch HaShalech Bracha B'Kriyazeh, blessed is Hashem, and the post can say, this is an actual bracha, with Shem Malchus, that the Baruch HaTashem, the Kenim Al-Khailam, HaShalech Bracha B'Kriyazeh, who sends a bracha in this pile of grain. A lot of the Rishonim hold, and this is how it's brought in Shulchan Aruch, is we're talking about specifically when he's measuring it in order to know how much Maaser to give. Truma, you have to give by estimate, but Maaser, you have to give exactly 1/10. And Truma's Maaser also, Truma's Maaser is for the lady to give, or whatever. Maaser Rishon and Maaser Sheni has to be exact, and therefore the person has to measure his granary to know. So they talk about this bracha that we're saying over here. To say a bracha, the Shema Malchus, would only be when he's measuring it for the purpose of doing the mitzvah. The Braisa continues, Modad v'achakach beirach. If he measured it, Marsha points out, it could also be, for example, lav dafka, you could say he's also measuring it because he needs to sell it, for example. So anyway, Modad v'achakach beirach, if he measured it and then said the bracha, how is it tefillas shav? Then it's a vain tefillah, it's a useless tefillah. Because at that point, once he started measuring already, then it's under the control of the eye, and like we just said, there's not going to be a bracha in it. Lefisha ain't a bracha mitzuya, loy b'davar ha-shokul. You don't find a bracha in things that are weighed, v'loy b'davar ha-modud, or things that are measured, v'loy b'davar ha-monu, or things that are counted, ela b'davar ha-samim in eye, and only things that are hidden from the eye, shkinem yitzav Hashem yitzchayas ha-bracha ba-samecha. So they say the same pasuk that the Gemara was quoting before, that only when the thing is hidden and stored away, then there's going to be a bracha in it. So Marsha brings from the Ramban that it applies only when he's going to do trumas and meisters. And why would the chachamim sakin a bracha dafka then that he should give a bracha to Hashem who increases it is because we have the pasuk where the Navi Malachi says bring the trumas and meisters and varikosi locham bracha ad blidai. So therefore, so now the chachamim will sakin a bracha to acknowledge that yes, Hashem is keeping his promise, and as a result of me giving my trumas and meisters, Hashem will increase my yield and make that I have more grain here than I thought I did. But again, he has to say that bracha before he starts measuring. Otherwise, we're saying it's a tefillah shav. If he wants to say it without Shema Malchus, then I suppose he could. But if he wants to say it with Shema Malchus, then Ramban and many other Rishonim hold that it would only be when he's measuring for truma and meister. But if he's measuring it for other purposes, then for Marsha says, then not necessarily then should he be saying that bakasha. Because after all, the bracha could be chal, regardless. But meiser, the fact is, you do have to measure. In other words, like this, if you're going to be selling it, let's say, fine, you're not necessarily selling the whole thing at once. You're going to sell it piecemeal, so you may never actually figure out exactly how much there was there. But when it comes to meiser, by definition, you have to know how much there was there. So therefore, that's going to prevent the bracha in the future. So therefore, the Chachamim said, make a bakasha and make a tefillah. But bracha before you start measuring it, so that to acknowledge that Hashem will send the bracha, and you're not gonna forfeit it because of this measurement, because the measurement itself was for the purpose of a mitzvah. Just make sure you do it before the measurement, because as we said, it has to be b'davar ha-samim in ayin. They talk about also in this connection that this is when the Eibishter tells Moshe Rabbeinu in the desert, for example, to count the Jewish people. So you would think then it's not going to be a davar asamim min ayin. Now we know the number, and nevertheless, the Eibishter is promising v'lo yibahem negif, that if you do it properly, then there will still be a bracha, and there'll still be an increase in the Jewish people. And don't worry about the fact that it's not asamim min ayin. Yom Yom Mashiach Gola, Chavtes Cheshvan. So the Rebbe talked about in a sicha that as far as tzedakah and as far as other mitzvahs, that in order to accomplish, in order to bring about the revelation and coming of Mashiach, take from Yad, every year has to increase in limud haTorah, especially in Yonim Mashiach Agula, and then very poshut to increase also in doing mitzvahs behidur, especially to be mahadur and mitzvah tzedakah, which after all tzedakah is considered in some senses like the ultimate mitzvah, the klolus of all the mitzvahs. That's what Rebbe explains in Tanya, and tzedakah we know is makar Rebbe says Agula. And in fact, the Rebbe talked about that it's good to connect them together. You give a Hosafa and Tzedakah together with Hosafa and Yonim Mashiach Agula, namely that the giving extra Tzedakah is for the purpose, is for the, with the motivation of bringing the Gula closer, and that itself is part of Limud of Yonim Gula Mashiach. Continuing on halachas of the bathroom, so we were talking about the various dinim of it. So now, if a person holds himself back from going to the bathroom, whether gedolim or ketanim, then he's over midrabbanon on the pasuk says al tishaktu es nafshei seichem, do not make yourselves disgusting. So now, when a person holds in urine or tzoya, then he's making himself disgusting. However, now the chachamim did not impose that requirement where there's covered abrius involved. So a person doesn't have to be there. A person feels the need to go, and right away, when he's going and going in public, he can go find a sneezed a place. And so similarly, also there are cases where he might feel the need in the middle of Shemana Esrei, in the middle of the brachas before Shema, and then he's entitled to wait a little bit, as the Alter Rebbe explains later in Shulchan Aruch, because they're not making a hefsek. In those places is serious enough. Later on the Alter Rebbe mentions this halacha, and later on in Siman Tzedek Beis, and then in the Siddur, the Alter Rebbe goes on and says that even in Pesukah de Zimra, where you're more allowed to interrupt, but if the person feels that he can hold him back, he doesn't feel such a desperate need, then he's not over on Baal Tashaktu by holding back until after davening. Now, yesh oimrim, furthermore, that b'chlal, when it comes to urine, then there's no issue of bal tishaktu, the issue is something else. There is a matter of sakana, because it might make the person sterile, the Gemara mentions in a few places, that holding back urine for too long can harm a man's fertility. Now, the rule will be, if he's able to hold himself until the amount of time that it takes to walk a parasa, which is going to be depending a parasa is you have the different shiur, the different opinions about how long it takes to walk a mil. A parasa is four times that. So yeshem, and that a parasa is 72 minutes. Yeshem, it's 96. So if a person just feels 72 or 96, as the case may be, and they have a shita, you have a shita of the Rambam that makes it to be 90 minutes. In any case, the point is, if a person is able to hold himself for that long, then it's not a matter of bal tishaktu, and it's not a matter of sakana l'divrei hakol. So in short, in other words, it's not the moment a person feels an urge, he right away has to rush off to the bathroom. It depends on how long, if he can evaluate himself and feel that he can wait that amount of time. And again, if it's during davening, then there's also more room for there's also a little more leeway. We're talking about, he's saying that, so yesh omen, that it applies equally to both tanim and gerlim. Yesh omen, that by tanim it's not bal tishaktu, it's a matter of danger. But if he can hold himself back to day hiluch parasa, then everybody agrees that there's no problem.
Number one.
Yeah, for both, either one, number for tzoya or for yak.